Okay, the third attribute of the canonicity is its corporate reception. And you talk a lot about the canonical core. Can you introduce us to that?
Just by way of review, so there's three attributes of canonicity. We've talked about divine qualities. The books have marks that are from God. Secondly, they're from apostles. They have apostolic content. And then the third attribute is that canonical books are received by the church, is what I call corporate reception. What I argue for in the last three chapters of my book is actually that reception by the church happened a lot sooner and was more widespread than typically critics of the New Testament will allow for. And one of the ways I get there to make that case is I argue for what I call a core New Testament. So when people ask, well, was there a canon or wasn't there in the early church? I say, well, look, you got to distinguish by what you mean. Was every single dispute resolved in the earliest phases? No. But what I do argue for is that there was a core canon in place almost as early as we can see. And what I mean by core is probably something around 22 of the 27 books of the New Testament seem to be fairly firmly in place by the middle of the second century. And really the middle of the second century, you start looking back further, much further than that, and things get really fuzzy in the historical sources. Hard to see much deeper than that. You have apostolic fathers, but they, you know, only refer to some canonical books. And so to say you have a core 22 out of the 27 by, say, the middle of the second century is remarkably early to have that much unanimity around that many books. And there's a lot of sources that we can appeal to that can tell us that there's this core. You know, one of the standard places we look to is the earliest list, what's known as the Muratorian Fragment, or also known as the Muratorian Canon, which is lists about 22 out of the 27 books. And when we talk about those, we're talking about the letters of Paul, 13 epistles of Paul, Acts, the four Gospels, probably something like 1 Peter, 1 John, Revelation, something along those lines is what we mean by the core. And then the remaining books, what you might call the disputed books, if we could even use that language, are going to be the smaller books, 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, James. These are the books that typically we're talking about when we talk about books that have a little bit more of a struggle in the canon. Now, once you realize that there's a core from the very start, it's a very important piece of the puzzle, because here's what it tells you. It tells you that first of all, there was widespread unanimity from a very early time about that core. In other words, there wasn't a lot of up-for-grabsness in the canon. Actually, much of it was settled. And the other thing it tells you is that the theological trajectory of Christianity was already established at a very early point. I mean, if you think about it, if you have 13 letters from Paul and four Gospels, your doctrine is going to be pretty much set. Regardless of what one might decide about 2 Peter, regardless of how the dust settles on 2nd and 3rd John, that's not going to change things much. The theological trajectory of Christianity is already established. So the concept of a core canon is really important.
Muratorian Fragment lists the Apocalypse of Peter and the Wisdom of Solomon at the end.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about the list, there's lots of things interesting about the Muratorian Fragment, is the list mentions those two books, the Apocalypse of Peter and the Wisdom of Solomon. People have speculated on what that means and why. A couple observations are worth making about that. First of all, it tells us again that the edges were fuzzy, that yes, you have a core, but you also have some ongoing dispute about a few books. The Apocalypse of Peter was popular in many circles, and apparently there were some that thought it should be in the canon. The Muratorian Fragment, though, seems hesitant about it. I forget the language off the top of my head, but basically this book, the Apocalypse of Peter, is acceptable to some but not all, is in essence what the Muratorian Fragment is indicating. But it's mentioned there at the end. The Wisdom of Solomon is more of an Old Testament, intertestamental book mentioned at the end. Some scholars have pointed out the fact that those two books are mentioned at the end of the Muratorian canon is suggestive that they are in the disputed category. In other words, it lists all the kind of agreed upon books first and then tosses in a couple that are up for grabs. And I think that's probably what's going on here. The order of the books is key. And the fact that those are mentioned at the end probably shows you that in the author's mind, they're teetering on the edge. And there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that. Yes, in the early centuries, there was a couple books that were on the edge, but the core was still there, and that's the principle to observe.
Some people have argued that the mere presence of heresy questions whether we can even talk about having a canon or perhaps even a core. How would you answer that?
Yeah, so what scholars do with this third attribute of canonicity is they say, look, the fact that the church eventually reached a consensus on these books doesn't mean anything, because in the early centuries, they're always fighting about stuff. And so the argument goes, yes, okay, fine. The church finally settled on these 27 books. But you evangelicals are overlooking the fact that in the 2nd century and the 3rd century and even in the beginning of the 4th century, there was a widespread disagreement, widespread disunity. People were using all kinds of apocryphal books, and there was no one agreeing on much of anything. And therefore, the later unity means nothing, so the argument goes. But, of course, I push back on that in the book. For one, I push back and I say, well, actually, it wasn't near as diverse, as people say. That's one way I push back. But the other way I push back is that, as I say, look, the mere use of apocryphal literature by the early church is not evidence that there wasn't a canon. There's almost this assumption in modern scholarship that if an early church father used an apocryphal book, then that must mean they didn't believe that there was a canon. That's a non sequitur. You can believe in a core canon and still find apocryphal literature beneficial, useful, although not scripture. And the key example of this is Clement of Alexandria. Clement of Alexandria, late 2nd century church father, very clear that when it came to which books were in the canon, he was very clear there was four and only four gospels. But yet what's interesting about Clement of Alexandria is he would also cite apocryphal gospels from time to time. He never cited them as scripture, but he would cite them as useful or beneficial or even helpful at points. And what we would say is that activity does not mean there wasn't a canon. You can cite those apocryphal books and still affirm that there's only four gospels that belong in the New Testament.
And that raises a very interesting question. That is the difference between a book being orthodox and a book being canonical.
Yes. And I get into that in my last chapter, but you raise a good issue there, is that people don't realize that the early church found many books useful and many books orthodox that were beyond the books they found to be in the canon. So another way to say it is, all canonical books are orthodox, but not all orthodox books are canonical. We have to remember that there's a slot in our understanding of early Christian reading practices for beneficial orthodox but not canonical books. A good example of this is The Shepherd of Hermas, which was a very popular book in the 2nd century. In particular, was widely spread around, widely copied and read. Most Christians, with a few minor exceptions, did not regard it as scripture, but yet it was deemed to be orthodox and helpful. That category, you got to understand, is there. And so you can be orthodox without being canonical, although you cannot be canonical without also being orthodox. And I point out to people that the same thing is true in our libraries. Sometimes we'll read a lot of books and even cite from a lot of books that are fully orthodox, but that aren't scripture. You know, we find them to be useful and helpful and beneficial, but no one would think that we consider them part of our Bibles. And that's an important distinction for us to maintain in the modern day, too.